For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's always a special pleasure when I can make the acquaintance of and welcome to the Morning Show for the first time a relatively new faculty colleague from Carthage College. In this case, Dr. Aaron Weber, who is Assistant Professor of Chemistry at Carthage. And Professor Weber made the news recently when it was announced that she was the recipient of a very significant research grant, just under $500,000, to help support work that she has just begun research into a particular potato virus. And this is something that could have potentially devastating effect on a huge portion of the potato crop of the world. And research into how this virus works and actually research into how we can further investigate this virus could really have tremendous benefits for all of us in terms of safeguarding the health of much of the world's potato crop, which is, of course, something that many, many people depend upon for nutrition. And so we're going to be talking with Professor Weber about her life in academia and this particular research work that she has been doing and the kind of difference that this research grant from the National Science Foundation could potentially make. Professor Weber, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Hello.
Glad to have this opportunity to really meet you, to not just see you from afar, but to actually get to know you. And since it is your first visit to the Morning Show, let's find out a little bit about where you're from originally. And of course, we're also really interested to know a bit about what drew you into the sciences.
Yeah, originally I'm from Minnesota, near the Twin Cities, one of the suburbs there. Hmm. I have been a science kid all of my life. I have loved science from the word go. I am particularly weird and stubborn in that I decided I was going to get a PhD when I was in fifth grade, when I learned my grandpa had one. And so I was going to be just like him. There was a picture of him on my desk at work.
Wow.
But I figured out it was going to be science in ninth grade, thanks to Science Fair. So again, early on, discovered that was going to be it, and figured out it was going to be biology and or chemistry, hence I had done biochemistry, kind of the middle of the two, when I got to college, because it involved both of them and I liked them. So surely that was my destiny. I had no idea what I was signing up for, but it turned out to be right.
Wow. So what about the sciences, and then particularly biology and chemistry, what was it, what about it did you enjoy so much?
I mean, I like setting stuff up and seeing what happened, right? I mean, who doesn't like going, okay, if I mix these together, now what's going to happen, right? Just that general curiosity I think so many of us feel when we have that opportunity to play with things and see outcomes. I've always been drawn. I love plants. It's convenient that I study them in a way now, but I do joke that I have a black thumb, and that's okay because part of my research is to kill them, so that's okay. But I mean, I've always liked watching growing things, and the more you learn about how the world works, the more you read, you find all the interesting ways that chemistry is really at the base of the beautiful colors we see, or you know, how crispy my potato chip is, or whatnot, right? There's so much under there that's just waiting to be explored, and so that's kind of how I stuck around with biochemistry of all things.
Fantastic. So I think most of us from the outside looking in have some idea of what biology is all about, and maybe a little less, but still have some idea of what chemistry is about. But what about the intersection between the two when we're talking about this thing called biochemistry?
Yeah, I mean, biochemistry is the chemistry of biological systems. So I think most people are familiar, at least, with the idea of organic chemistry. The common course you take as your sophomore year, whether you're going to be a doctor or you're going to be a researcher like me, it's pretty much what you take second year. And that's all chemistry related to things with carbon and hydrogen. And I won't embarrass myself more by going any further in depth than that for the sake of my organic chemistry colleagues. But biochemistry is that similar focus, but looking at the reactions that go on in biological systems. Organic chemistry does not generally go on in biological systems. So we're just shifting to, you know, when you talk about enzymes. Enzymes are a hallmark of biochemistry.
Mm. So you're kind of investigating how enzymes work, how they do what they do?
That's a pretty big focus of biochemistry is enzyme-based work, yes. What I'm doing isn't necessarily, but that's a pretty common feature.
Right. Very good. So this particular grant from the National Science Foundation, we'll get to the stuff of it in just a second, but I want to talk about the rather cumbersome name, which is, if I understand correctly, you received the Building Research Capacity of New Faculty in Biology grant. So it sounds like you were given, earned this significant grant in part for being a new faculty person. I mean, that this is at least partly earmarked for people who are relatively new to the world of academia. Is that right? And it kind of explain why that makes sense to earmark certain grant funds in this way.
Yeah, it's also unique in that it's earmarked for primarily undergraduate institutions.
Ah.
So for schools, particularly small liberal arts colleges like Carthage College, it's a unique stream of funding that is going to make a huge difference for both myself and my students and Carthage as a whole. The reason to support new faculty is we're new. And when you're brought into a program, you inherit what other people have, right? And unfortunately, that doesn't always mean that they did what you do, right? The person who was the previous biochemist doesn't necessarily use the same techniques that I do or require the same instrumentation that I do. And the ability to get that without external support is hard to get equipment. Those are big investments for both this college and the department. And without external support to help us purchase these things, realistically, it's not something that a smaller institution is going to be able to do very easily.
Mm.
And so the grant, in addition to being for new faculty, being for primarily undergraduate institutions, I, as a professor at a liberal arts college, will never be competitive for the big, big grants that that professors at big schools with lots of research are competitive for.
Hmm.
And so the fact that this grant is designed to help new faculty set up labs to provide experiences to undergraduates at smaller liberal arts colleges to help those students access and get experience with cutting-edge techniques is really valuable and a rare funding opportunity in the world of academia.
And you got it. You earned it.
Yes.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I am speaking today on the morning show with Dr. Aaron Weber, who is assistant professor of chemistry at Carthage College, and more to the point, or more specifically to the point, the recipient of a very significant grant of $498,000 from the National Science Foundation. And as we've just been talking, a grant earmarked specifically for someone who is relatively new to the world of academia as a faculty member to underwrite and allow them to continue with research which they have begun. And you were telling me, Professor Weber, before we went on the air, that this research that we are about to talk about is something that you have already begun, even ahead of this grant. This grant is not like the starter pistol for you to begin this research, and yet you have just maybe, sounds like, begun to lay the groundwork for what can happen from this point on. So tell us about kind of the genesis of this research work that now is going to be supported by this impressive grant.
This work starts back with Dr. Paul Bethke at the University of Wisconsin-Madison when I was a postdoctoral fellow in his lab. So he studies, or he just retired, he studied potato physiology, and I was brought on to study potato virus, the potato virus Y, and the impact of that virus on the condition of the potatoes as they were kept in storage prior to becoming potato chips. And so I never thought I would ever know how to do potato chips, but I can now make a mean potato chip. But so the work started when I was in his lab. He was a wonderful mentor in many ways, including encouraging me to ask interesting questions. And so I had a background in studying HIV as a graduate student, and that brought with it some questions about how the virus worked at the more molecular level than the lab was focused on at the moment. And so he encouraged me to think those thoughts and start to build out what my research program would look like when I got a job as an independent researcher on my own as a professor somewhere.
Wow. So that's where it began. Mm-hmm. So you began with adjacent research work at UW-Madison. Mm-hmm. And then with his encouragement of this mentor's encouragement, you began to kind of strike out in a maybe like a parallel course.
Yep.
I think I understand. By the way, I'm so intrigued by the notion of potato physiology. I think that's just the last thing would ever occur to us that a potato even has physiology. I mean, it just seems like the most basic sort of thing, even just from the way it comes out of the ground. It doesn't even hang on a vine, you know.
They are so fascinating.
Yeah.
It's my party trick now is to pull out a bag of potato chips and tell you about the life of the potato that is now your chip in front of you. There is so much work that goes into food production. And as consumers, we have very specific requirements for what we want our potato chips to look like, for example. Most of us don't want them to be too dark. And so how a potato producer ensures that the chip that you and I get is that light color that we want and doesn't have any of that dark staining, there's a lot of work that goes into that.
Interesting. And, I mean, we could probably spend hours just talking about that, but in a nutshell, what are we talking about in terms of the physiology of the potato where there is that kind of difference? I mean, like, the difference between a light-colored potato and a dark-colored potato, what actually is different in those two potatoes, aside from what we see with the naked eye?
Yeah, so what's happening is the potato that they harvest from the ground ends up going into cold storage. And the rate at which that temperature is lowered to its final temperature, the amount of degree change over time, how fast or how slow, and then how long that potato sits in cold storage impacts how much sugar is in the potato. It continues to convert starch into sugar. It's respiring. And then when you fry that sugar, that can lead to the dark color. And so trying to prevent excessive sugar accumulation to prevent the eventual Maillard reaction that leads to dark color or acrylamide is, that's how you get a light potato chip or a dark potato chip, is how much sugar is built up.
Wow. And does that alteration of the level of sugar, does that affect the taste significantly? I mean, we might assume it that it would, or are we not talking about that?
No, it can be, it's bitter. It can be bitter. The dark color, the acrylamide has a slight bitter taste to it, and most people don't like that.
So remind us again of the work that you were doing in Madison. I mean, specifically, what were you exploring, you and your mentor, and I assume others as well, in this lab?
So we were looking at the impact of potato virus infection in field in season, so I would go out and plant a field of potatoes and then intentionally infect in a random manner different varieties or strains of potato virus into those organisms, and then look at the quality of the tuber, the yield, how much, how many, and then also the sugar quality as the tubers were stored over the season.
Okay. So we are talking about a virus that I think the shorthand of it is PVY.
Correct.
The potato virus Y. So first of all, are we talking about out in the world a vast array of viruses that can infect potatoes, and this virus Y being just one of them?
Yes.
But why does it attract your attention? I mean, why is it specifically significant?
So potato virus Y, and we did start with A, and we ended up all the way down. We have many of them. Not all of them are actually of agricultural concern. Potato virus Y can have up to, estimates range up to 80% loss in a field. So if a farmer were to plant potatoes and have that field become infected with potato virus Y, they could effectively lose all the crop. And so that's wow. That's a pretty devastating thing. Even losing less than 80% does affect the ability of the farmer to their bottom line. If they lose not 80%, losing less is actually harm, right? That's also a problem, to lose something like 10 or 20%, because that's just less product for them.
Yeah.
And so potato virus Y is one of the bigger viruses for potatoes. There are many, just like there are many viruses that we as humans encounter. But potato virus Y is fairly well studied and has well documented negative outcomes for farmers and potato producers alike.
So this, I'm intrigued by this figure of 80%. I mean, like, where does that come from, or what exactly is that measuring? Is it that there is that percentage of potatoes that are susceptible to this virus, or just that's more a marker of how effective the virus itself is?
It's more of a, if you were going to plant a potato and grow it, and the mass of tubers, if you were going to fill a bag like you would get at the grocery store, you would have 80% less in that bag from one plant than its neighbor that wasn't infected.
Gotcha. Oh, that reminds me. Yeah, so that's right. A potato plant yields more than one potato. And
yes.
So how common, that is, how widespread is this virus, PVY? I mean, what kind of damage at the moment is it doing? How present is it in the world?
Potato virus Y is found everywhere potatoes are grown.
So all the time we're losing 80% of our potato crop, or?
No, not every time we have PVY do we have 80% loss. There are different varieties of the virus. So different, just like we have different strains of the flu, there are different strains of potato virus Y. And there are different types of potatoes. So there are russet Burbanks and there are redskins. There are different varieties of potato. Some varieties are more susceptible to some of the viral strains. Some are less. There are a lot of confounding factors when you grow a field full of something, other environmental factors that can impact the yield. So the range is wide that you can expect on a potato virus loss, something very little all the way up to 80%.
Right. And when it does its worst damage, what exactly happens? I mean, are we seeing a potato plant that just does not yield any potatoes whatsoever, or many fewer, or is that they are yielding potatoes that are unusable, rendered unusable by this virus? I mean, what exactly is the nature of the damage that this virus potentially can do?
So in the right combination of potato virus infecting the right cultivar of potato, the plant will die.
Oh, it dies altogether.
So there is no tuber yield. So truly, I could have said up to 100%, but it's a wishy-washy statistic.
Sure.
I'm sorry. It depends on so many factors.
Of course, absolutely. And I think you've done a great job of clarifying that, because I think, again, for those of us who are city slickers and really much more ignorant than we should be about such matters, I mean, it's very easy to kind of tilt towards very simplistic ideas about how all of this works, and you're painting a picture that is complicated, and that in and of itself underscores the importance of some of the research that is going on, including the research that you are doing. Ahead of us talking specifically about that, roughly how long has this thing called PVY been around? I mean, forever as far as we know? Or, I mean, is it a long history in terms of scientists knowing about this and being concerned with it, or is it relatively new?
It's a long history. It is one of the well-studied viruses we have for potatoes, yes.
Goes back a long way. So the research that you want to do, if I understand correctly, in a sense has to do with helping scientists to be better equipped to study PVY, to study this virus and how it does what it does. Is that
yes.
a rough summary
yep.
of what?
Yep.
So tell our listeners about that, about the tools that you are interested in trying to develop that could make a big difference in us better understanding PVY and its potentially devastating effects.
So the challenges with studying PVY come from the fact that there are many strains of the virus, and there are a lot of different cultivars or varieties of potato. And the complex interaction of strains and cultivar make it really hard to predict the outcome. It also makes it really hard to explain what's going on at the molecular level, such that some of the virus's strains are very good at killing some of the cultivars of potato, whereas other cultivars of potato have no response to being infected by the virus.
Like they're immune.
They are infected, so that's not they just don't have the symptoms. There's no outcome. And so understanding genetically what's going on, molecularly what's going on, at the biochemical level what's going on between the virus and the host is a big interest. So one of the tools is a tool to help understand by kind of piecing apart the virus, pulling apart at the different known genetic variants, the different strains, and say, if this part of the virus is strain O, is the overall virus more infectious? Or if we make it a different strain, so the other big strain is what's known as strain N. If we make it strain N at this one piece, is that overall virus more infectious? So one of the tools is creating a virus in the lab that we can manipulate using common tools. And then in the greenhouse, infect tobacco, which is a model organism, and eventually potato, to see how our specifically designed virus, how piecing apart those individual proteins in the virus lead to more or less infection, getting at identifying eventually what about the plant is responding when it's viral strain O versus viral strain N.
So what's going on that makes this given potato plant more susceptible to the damage that this virus does? So it sounds like at the moment, do we have no idea about that?
No, to be sure, we have lots of information about what the virus, the different viral proteins do. We have a wealth of knowledge about this whole family of viruses, the potiviral family, but there are still some portions of the virus that are less well understood. And so those are definite targets for myself and many other researchers, understanding what those small, less well-understood proteins do. There's also the added fact that this virus only has 11 proteins, and yet it runs an entire life cycle. So every viral protein does many things. Think Swiss Army knife, right? Each protein has to have multiple interactions. And so we might know some of the host-virus interactions, but it's also very likely we don't know all of them yet.
Wow. So I already am getting some sense of why it takes money to do this kind of research, because this is not just look at something under a microscope stuff. This is on a higher level, I should think, just in terms of research equipment specifically geared to do this kind of work. So I don't even know how it's possible, but is there a way you can describe the kind of technical equipment that you hope to, or maybe have already brought to Carthage in order to allow this to go forward?
Yeah, so the biggest piece of equipment is, my pride and joy, is a piece of equipment that will help us purify proteins more efficiently and effectively. Mm. And that's really important when we're working with undergraduates who have limited availability. Bigger institutions that are research geared have graduate students, so students whose job it is to be in lab as they earn either a master's or a PhD themselves. And they also, bigger institutions also have postdoctoral researchers, like I was at Madison,
right,
whose full-time job is to do research. At smaller institutions like Carthage, we don't have that because we are focused on undergraduates. And so finding ways to maximize the time that students have available to do work is really important. And so this piece of equipment is allowing me to purify proteins, allow my students to purify proteins without having to watch it the whole time.
Ah.
And so that's a really important a piece of equipment, especially for some of the other work we're doing. And then getting updated pieces of equipment for growing these different organisms that I need to grow, right? Mm. Growing different species of, we grow bacteria, two different types of bacteria and yeast and plants in my lab. So the ability to do all of that requires, or is aided by up-to-date equipment.
Right. So this, the development of these two biochemical tools that that this is the kind of the heart and soul of this work under this grant. Is this mean developing tools that then you yourself potentially could utilize in further study, or are you mostly fascinated with the tools themselves? And at the end of this, are you likely to explore other tools or to kind of go off in that direction? Does that question make sense?
That question makes sense. The answer is both, right? As a tinkering scientist, these tools will be made and shared. That is part of the scientific philosophy, is I will make these things and share these with other institutions and people who are interested in using them. People that have full-on potato research units can take these and do massive things with these tools that I would not necessarily be interested in doing and also couldn't do, right? And so that's part of that. I do have other ideas cooking in the back of my mind of other potentially interesting viral targets, but potato virus Y currently has my attention, and I will use these tools until I get them all figured out and tinkered, and then they might pull out other ones.
Sure. So what is, in a sense, the best case scenario in terms of should these biochemical tools be successfully developed? And I'm actually kind of curious too. If it's possible to know at this point with any certainty that these tools will come into being and be something that scientists can utilize, but assuming that they can be, then what is the most significant benefit that you see down the road in terms of you and other scientists utilizing these tools? What could that potentially lead to?
So the part I've already described about creating the virus that we can tinker with to identify how the potato and virus interact, that has a lot of potential for figuring out how to identify good immune response within different cultivars of potato. So if we know how the virus is attempting to infect the plant, and we can use different, we can survey the variety of potato, different types of potatoes that we grow, we could perhaps identify within those potatoes different resistance mechanisms. And then those resistance genes could be put into other potato cultivars we like. So the idea that we could find develop resistance mechanisms that then are implemented into the crops we grow. The other part of the grant, the other biochemical tool, is effectively a reporter to identify the presence of the virus. Hmm. And that is one that I could see being useful in diagnostics at the field. So identifying a plant that you think might be kind of sick and using this reporter to say, yes, it has the virus, no, it doesn't have the virus. And then if the plant was sick, you pull it from the field. You rogue it, you remove it, you remove the source of virus that could infect its neighbors.
Right. That could be huge. So the grant is for 3 years, $498,000. And in a sense, as you embark on this, is it with a fervent hope that you will arrive at some successful outcome before those 3 years are up?
Oh, always. Always. If you're not excited and sure you're going to do something fun, it's hard to get up and going. But I am enthusiastic and excited about what we can get done with this.
Right. And do you have in your mind a rather specific timeline of what will happen when?
Oh, yes. And I have told the granting agencies that timeline as well. We have to be very explicit in these grants to say, you know, this is, we expect this to be done within so many months, 18 months, a year, 2 years, that kind of thing. There are lots of deadlines and timelines.
Right. I should think science does not always cooperate. I mean,
No, it does not.
There will be, I assume, roadblocks and dead ends and diversions and detours and so on.
Yep.
And does this timeline allow for that?
Yes. Yes. There are redundancies built in. There are pitfalls that I've already identified, and I have backup plans that are also being pursued alongside what I hope will be the ideal route.
Right. And a last question. Is what you're doing, this work, is it limited to the universe of potatoes, or is there any potential applicability to, I don't know, sweet potatoes or yams or I mean, roughly similar sorts of crops that might also be affected by viruses?
So the beautiful thing about science is that you can apply it so generally. So the work with the viral constructs, potato virus Y is a member of a larger family known as potiviruses, and there are many of those viruses. So anything we learn about potato virus Y in particular could be useful in understanding these other virus family members. And the beautiful thing about the detection tool is that it also has some really wide ranging potential applications depending on how you just tweak the setup. So once we figure out the parameters, these are very much set up so that they could be adapted to be used on all kinds of different stuff.
Incredible. Well, we are going to be following this with very, very great interest, and I hope at some point over the next 3 years it's going to be possible for us to have a follow-up conversation and hear more about this important work that you're doing,
you absolutely.
And your students. Dr. Aaron Weber, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at Carthage College and the recipient of this significant grant from the National Science Foundation. Thank you so much for making time in your schedule to be my morning show guest today. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out the hour, I'm going into the morning show archives for a really fun interview about the potato featuring the great late Raghavan Iyer, one of the world's most renowned chefs. This interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2016. On one previous occasion, I had the pleasure of speaking with Raghavan Iyer about one of his previous books. He is a master chef and author of several different cookbooks, including 660 Curries. And he has written for such publications as Cooking Light, Eating Well, Weight Watchers magazine. He happens to be an addict. His addiction is potatoes. And that is the subject of his latest book, published by Workman, called Smashed, Mashed, Boiled, and Baked, and Fried, Too, A Celebration of Potatoes in 75 Irresistible Recipes. Raghavan Iyer, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Greg. And this is one of those times when I can say I'm proud to be an addict.
Exactly. Before we talk about kind of the genesis of the book specifically, I want you to talk about just how long potatoes have been such a central part of your life and a source of such passion. It sounds like they were served extensively in your home growing up in Mumbai.
Yes, very much so. I would say ever since I was a child, you know, my earliest memories have always been about potatoes. And, you know, also being the youngest child, my mother would always, you know, would get preferential treatment. And she would always say, what do I want for, you know, a meal, whether it's breakfast, lunch, or dinner? And I would always say potato. And I think after a while, she just stopped asking. It's like, why bother? It's going to be the same answer. So it's something that has always stuck with me over the years. And so I think when the opportunity came to do a book on potatoes, you know, it was a dream come true. So that was, it's a passion that is 55 years old for sure.
Tell our listeners about the meal you enjoyed at a Turkish restaurant, I think maybe with a friend, which was really kind of the direct impetus for this book being written.
Yes, this was actually my friend and my editor, Suzanne Rafer, with Workman Publishing. We had, this is my third book with Suzanne, sixth in totality, but I remember we had, she had taken me to a Turkish restaurant for dinner, and she had ordered potatoes, which came as a side dish, and I said, gee, Suzanne, how about a book on potatoes? And she goes, sold. It was a quick conversation, and we and that was it. And then the next morning, I got a call from my agent, and then I put together a two-page proposal for the book, and they went back and forth, and I got a contract to do a book on potatoes. But that is, you know, one of the things that to me was so important is the international nature of potatoes. You know, there's a reason why, Greg, this is the fourth largest crop in the world, because it is so versatile, it is so pervasive, and it is extremely accessible even to the common person. It's a cheap vegetable, it's also nutritionally solid. So from a standpoint of being able to, you know, have been embraced by the entire world, I felt I needed to do justice to a vegetable like that.
You give us a historical overview of the potato, and one thing I would love for you to explain to our listeners is, although we can trace the potato way, way back to the Andean culture, you tell us it's really not until the Incas that the potato, in a sense, takes center stage. I think in your words, it's full potential is unleashed or something. What did the Incas figure out about the potato?
They figured out how to actually cultivate it in ways that were much more conducive to larger crops and the different varieties that grow well. You know, and they were able to, you know, use fairly sophisticated agricultural tools to come up with ways that they could make the potato survive these different shifts of climate, you know, within short time periods. And so I think, to me, they were masters at doing that. And then, of course, you know, from there, it just sort of blossomed into the world. And that's one of the reasons why, to this day in South America, I think they are just there alone because of the soil conditions. They're able to cultivate over 3,000 varieties of potatoes. And so that, to me, is truly the epicenter of potatoes.
You tell us in the book that there are actually 5,000 or more varieties of potatoes all around the world, and yet we can categorize them fairly simply in two directions, flowery and waxy. And this is something I never knew till I picked up your book, although then I sort of rewound in my mind and realized, oh, yeah, that's right. I think I see exactly what he's talking about there. Explain why it's important to have that distinction in mind when one, for instance, is shopping for potatoes.
Because I think, you know, the starch content of a potato determines what the cooking methods are ideal for those. And so when you think about the floury or the starchy potatoes, and you think about the russets, and you think about, you know, the white potatoes that usually fall under that category, high in starch, low in moisture, And I think because of that, those varieties of potatoes lend themselves well for, you know, mashing and for baking and for deep frying because of the low moisture content. But on the other end of the spectrum, when you look at the other variety, the waxy potatoes, or people call them boilers, red potatoes are very common. Fingerlings fall under that category as well. These potatoes have high moisture and low starch, and so because of that, they lend themselves well for boiling. And if you want to pan fry them and you want to keep the shape intact, they're very cohesive because of that. So they're beautiful for that. So they're not very good interchangeably. So you can't take a red potato, for instance, and fry them. You know, you're not going to get the same results as you would get with a starchy potato. So the type of potato makes a big determination of, you know, what cooking methods you can apply to those.
You also point out that although often they get included, that in fact we have to be careful to know that a sweet potato is actually no relative to the potato at all. I had not realized that.
Yeah, the potatoes, for instance, they come from the same family as the nightshade variety of plants. You know, tomatoes, eggplant, to name some of, you know, its siblings. But the sweet potato actually comes from the morning glory family. And those, you know, unlike regular potatoes, sweet potato leaves, for instance, are very edible. And they're incredibly sweet, and they're delicious even if you just stir fry them. If you have, access to sweet potato leaves, they are very, very good in stir fry because of its inherent sweetness. But unlike those, you know, you cannot do the same with the potato greens because, first of all, you know, when the potato are harvested, especially towards the end of summer, early fall, the leaves are always dried, you know, on the ground before you yank them out, unless you're working with new potatoes, which are actually harvested early spring, where the leaves are still green, and that's when you yank them out, and then you eat the new potatoes. But that's really the big difference between the two.
Mm. Your book is full of what are called tater tips, all kinds of, you know, sort of bite-sized items of information, including some great advice on how to properly choose a potato and also how to properly store a potato. The one little interesting bit of information was your admonition that we should not store potatoes in the refrigerator. Tell us what happens if you do that.
Yes. If because potatoes, the starch of the potato gets converted to sugars in the refrigerator. So you should never store your potatoes in the refrigerator. Unless, you want to make, let's we talked about, making French fries. So if you want to make potatoes that you don't want to deep fry, but you want to bake them in the oven instead, at that time, I would say you're much better off than storing that potato in the refrigerator, because then you're letting your starch convert to sugar. And so when you're baking it, then, it becomes nice and brown and crispy. That's what you're looking for. So that's the only time you would, but otherwise I would say never store your potatoes in the refrigerator. Cool, dark spots, in your pantry is the perfect spot for that. And then, you replenish your stock often and you have the right potato. But if you're privy to actually, if you're living close to a farm, for instance, and you can get fresh dug potatoes with the mud still around it, store it that way. In your pantry, and then that way, as and when it lasts you throughout the winter, and if it's nice and cool, and then you scrub them, and you've got fresh potatoes at your beck and call. So
fantastic. We need to mention that there are 75 wonderful recipes in this book, divided into 6 different chapters, all the way from munchies, tidbits, and finger foods, all the way to dessert, and one doesn't often think of potatoes with dessert. I want to mention also the fact that people might pick up your book in a bookstore, take a look at the lengthy recipes, and jump to the conclusion that these are complicated recipes, difficult to prepare. And it's probably really important for people to understand that these recipes are lengthy because they're detailed, not because they're complicated, and that's a really important difference.
Thank you so much for mentioning that. Yes, as a cooking teacher of 25 years, you know, I mean, I've always said my role as a teacher is to explain, you know, techniques, and, you know, there's a reason why we do certain things. And so when they're reading the steps, for instance, they get the impression that I'm in the kitchen with them as they're cooking. So it tells them what to look for, what the end result should be, what's the aroma, what's the color change. And so the explanations are detailed because it's a teaching tool. But from the standpoint of the recipe itself, all these recipes are extremely simple to execute. Some of them have, you know, many of them, in fact, have 10 ingredients or less. And so so simplicity of executing is very, very high. But the detailness and the length of the recipe comes from the explanations that you mentioned, which I feel is important.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that they are there. Let's take a couple minutes to talk about a couple of the most intriguing recipes. I want to start with one that I cannot wait to prepare myself, because I've really fallen in love with chorizo. And so you have a recipe for chorizo stuffed hash browns. And I think this is a recipe that comes from Mexico.
Uh-huh. And, you know, of course, morning favorites. You know, who doesn't love a really good hash brown? And I think... you know, when you think about taking the shredded potatoes, and the way it's stuffed is, you know, you have this layer of shredded potatoes, and then I have the chorizo, which is sort of the sandwich layer, and then on top of it, you know, I put the second layer of potato. And oftentimes, the potatoes themselves, the shreds, I mix it up with a little bit of egg in there, so it binds it together beautifully well, and so you get this you know, almost like a potato sandwich, for lack of a better description, with the chorizo in between, and pan fry both sides, and sometimes I'll throw in fresh spinach in there, you know, to give it some color and texture and further nutritional value to that as well, and you've got this breakfast complexity, you know, that's one skillet meal, I think, and that's a beautiful, beautiful dish to consume in the morning.
Very good. Why don't I play fair here and give you a chance to highlight a recipe that you think is especially noteworthy?
You know, I am, when you give me potatoes, that's noteworthy, but when you tell me these are fried, I sort of get weak in the knees. I love, and it's a favorite of mine, you know, who doesn't love a good tater tot, you know? And so I have homemade tater tots, which are cheesy tater tots with fresh tarragon. And it's truly one of those recipes that I, you know, tested and retested about half a dozen times. Not because the recipe wouldn't work the first time, because I loved it so much the first time that I kept doing it again and again. Mm. And it's
well, that's how you achieve perfection. Well, let's remind our listeners of the title of the book, Smashed, Mashed, Boiled, and Baked, and Fried to a Celebration of Potatoes in 75 Irresistible Recipes, published by Workman. Raghavan Iyer, it's been great to talk with you, and thank you for this wonderful, wonderful book.
Thank you so much, Greg, and it's my pleasure, and I hope you and your listeners have a great holiday.
You too. Monday on the morning show, we'll be talking with Buddy Levy about his fascinating book that is called Realm of Ice and Sky, chronicling some of the earliest attempts to reach the North Pole via the air. On Tuesday, two faculty colleagues from Carthage, Dr. Jeffrey Roberg and Dr. Maribel Morales Martinez, discuss a recent study trip to Cuba. On Wednesday, the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin Parkside, Dr. Lynn Akey. On Thursday, Kaylin Palomares' February visit to the morning show. A week from today, a Valentine's Day special. Partly sunny skies in our forecast, breezy and seasonal conditions, a high today of 31 degrees. Overnight, Cloudy skies, a low of 25. Tomorrow, Saturday, cloudy and seasonal, and also in the mix, the possibility of an inch or so of snow, a high of 33 degrees. Continued cold on Sunday and Monday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elk.